From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlin. February is Black History Month. Since 1970, this month has been dedicated to celebrating the contributions and achievements of African Americans. Today, we'll talk about the Bank Black movement, some tragic history in Savannah, a daring escape from Macon, and even how to handle a controversial term in the classroom. But we would love to hear from you. Tell us some hidden history about African Americans that you know, or maybe just tell us about a person that you think does not get the credit that they deserve. Call us at 404-500-9457 or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. When you look at Oprah or Jay-Z or Will Smith, for example, do you think Black or African American? For many of us, those two terms are interchangeable, but research suggests they're not actually equal, at least not in terms of how we perceive them. Erica Hall is an assistant professor of organization and management at Emory University's Goizueta Business School. She worked on a study on this issue and spoke to me in 2015.
Initially, I was having these very interesting cocktail conversations with a white counterpart, and I'd noticed that I would refer to myself as a Black person, and then when they went back to refer to somebody of my race, they would say African American. So I was noticing that there was this distance from the term Black. So I wondered whether there was any stigma attached to Black that they didn't necessarily want to say it, even though I was self-identifying as such.
What differences did you find? Why would people be hesitant to call somebody Black?
So we did a series of experiments, and we found that white participants tend to think that those that are labeled Black are of lower socioeconomic status than those that are labeled African American. And because we tend to perceive people of lower socioeconomic status more negatively, we found that when people were called Black, they were perceived more negatively than when they were called African American.
People even thought they were more likely to be criminals.
Absolutely. Yes. So we did one particular study where we had a crime report of a suspect, and the suspect was either labeled as an African-American suspect or a Black suspect. And what we found was the people who were randomly assigned to look at the vignette where the person was labeled a Black suspect perceived that suspect more negatively than
thought they were more likely to be guilty.
Well, specifically, we had a thermometer and said, how warm are you to this person? And these ideas or these particular sentiments come out in jury decisions, right? How warm are you to a suspect?
Meaning that theoretically, and I'm making absolutely no accusations against hypothetical people, but meaning that that could be exploited depending on how you describe someone.
Oh, definitely.
Either in a police report or in front of a jury.
Absolutely.
But is there anything other negative associated with this? Let's say, for example, let's say you submit your resume. Your resume won't say whether you're Black or African American.
Actually, it may, because a lot of times on resumes, we cite certain groups or organizations that we're in. So we have the African American Student Union, the Black Lawyers Association, and these could have certain connotations, right, of lower socioeconomic status or higher socioeconomic status. We did one experiment where we looked at application forms. And on application forms, you're often given a chance to self-identify whether you're Black or African American.
Yeah, it's usually optional, yeah.
Yes. So we had two identical application forms with the person, same credential, same person. The only thing that differed was some participants were randomly assigned to see an application where the person listed their race as Black, and some participants were randomly assigned to see an application where the race was listed as African American. Now, those that looked at the application where it was listed as Black thought that that person had lower education, lower social status, made less money or salary, and was less likely to be in a managerial position.
Exact same application.
Exact same application. The only difference was the label, Black or African American.
Why? Do we have any idea why?
So we have a couple of theories of why, but we didn't directly test it in the paper. The why behind it. We're thinking that many of this could have stemmed from the Black Power movement, where part of the message going out was that we're struggling here. As a minority, we're lower socioeconomic status, we're poor, and we're degraded because of government policies and things like that. And so this may have been associated with the Black Panther movement and the Black Power movement, which was ostensibly associated with the term Black. So we're saying that it could be a remnant from that time, but it's something that we have to test.
So does this make you hesitant to label yourself as Black?
It absolutely does. And prior to conducting the research, I readily self-identified as Black. I think I preferred the label. But now I'm thinking of the consequences constantly of labeling myself as a Black person.
So you second guess yourself.
I definitely second guess myself.
And you started calling yourself African American?
In certain contexts, definitely.
This isn't a choice for many people who just aren't African American. I mean, if they're from Haiti, your choice is to say Haitian, I guess?
Yes, you could definitely say Haitian. But I think the interesting thing about the United States is that these labels are perceived to be interchangeable. So if you look at the United States Census or governmental forms, they say Black or African American, saying that you really can't choose between each one, right? There are a lot of guidelines for APA guidelines or journalistic guidelines that say that you can use either term to refer to somebody. So because they're seen as the same group or referring to the same group, it's interesting that there are these connotation differences.
So where's the next place you go with this research? What do you study next?
We're trying to see if there are any potential positive benefits to the term Black. We're also going to look into Hispanic versus Latino. It's very interesting that we found these slight differences for Black versus African American. So perhaps there can be something for American Indian or Native American, Hispanic, Latino, and other different ethnic labels.
And for you personally, I wonder about that moment when you're about to self-identify and you have to make a choice between saying Black or African American. What's going through your head? What calculation is going through your head?
I'm immediately thinking of the consequences in that particular situation. So am I in an employment situation? Am I being evaluated by a white perceiver? Am I in a judicial situation? In all those aforementioned situations, I think I'd be more likely to identify as African American. However, if I was among other Blacks or African Americans, I probably would use Black. So it's completely contextual.
And what have you said to like your friends and family? Stop referring to yourself as Black if you're speaking to a Caucasian?
No, the thing is, I don't want to make any blanket suggestions because this is intricate, right? There are a lot of different intricacies here. I just want them to know that in certain contexts, it probably would not be beneficial to refer to yourself as Black. And that's just the sad truth of it.
That is a very sad truth.
Extremely.
So your next research is to study Hispanic versus Latino. Where do you go with the Black versus African American study, though?
For the Black versus African American, we're going to test it out in different contexts. So here we did employment context, judicial context, and we even did a media study. But we're going to look at victims of racial profiling. We're going to look at differences between Black and African American.
I mean, in terms of whether the police officer arresting them identified them as either Black or African American?
No, in court cases. So, for example, we did one particular study about Trayvon Martin.
Uh-huh.
And we found that when Trayvon Martin was labeled as Black, people...
Trayvon Martin was the young man in Florida who was shot by George Zimmerman in a confrontation, in which George Zimmerman was found innocent. But you're saying that you labeled him as...
Black versus African American because people tend to believe, or research suggests, that only African Americans of low socioeconomic status have racial profiling problems. So people with higher socioeconomic status, like Barack Obama, race doesn't matter to him, right? So a potential benefit...
Which is not statistically true.
Exactly, but this is just the perception.
Right.
Right, so... potential benefit here was when we labeled Trayvon Martin as Black, people were more likely to think that he was persecuted by George Zimmerman.
Erica Hall is an assistant professor of organization and management at Emory University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Atlanta-based Citizens Trust had more than 8,000 new accounts opened in 1 month last summer. Citizens Trust is one of the country's oldest African-American-owned banks. The spike in new accounts is due in part to a new economic movement called Bank Black.
You can go to your bank tomorrow and you can say, until you as a corporation start to speak on our behalf, I want all my money.
Right.
And I'm taking all my money to Citizens Trust.
That's Atlanta rapper Killer Mike. On Second Thought, intern Olivia Reingold spoke with a new applicant about why she decided to bank Black.
I do consider Banking Black a movement. It is a way of recognizing the power that we may not recognize that we have. My name is Tiara Carter. I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm currently working as a nurse. I used to bank at SunTrust, so I'm moving my account from SunTrust to Citizens Trust Bank. I drove from Kennesaw to Atlanta to open up this account to support. Currently, you know, there's protesting going on, which is great, you know, a form of expression, but I think it's really important that we actually make moves that actually make a difference, and this is one of them. My mom taught me growing up, you always do something for a reason. And recently, and I really can't think of the guy's name that I saw on the internet, and he was talking about the money that we put in our churches actually go to white banks. But if I go to those banks to apply for a loan, then I'm often denied. And that kind of resonated in me, and it already supported the idea that I wanted to give back and support Black-owned businesses. Everybody has their own motivation, and I was already motivated. And to see others motivated, it kind of gave me the will to drive 50 plus miles, you know, to open up the account. I'm not opening an account at a Black-owned bank because I'm Black, or because I'm Black and they're Black that they will, you know, make shortcuts or look out for me. And opening this account at a Black-owned bank is me supporting entrepreneurship of our community. That's my main goal. And I think it has a lot to do with educating ourselves. And that's very, very important. Again, to see where the money goes and see the effect that our money has. We have power. And I did not always recognize it. And it goes back to the Black Lives Matter movement. We shouldn't have to say it. A lot of people think, well, all lives matter. And it's like, yes, it does. But when we are targeted and we're dealing with issues as people of color, we have to be specific. And we have to call people out. And it's time to call people of color out for us to educate ourselves and realize the power that we have. And this is a monumental movement for us. Our money goes a long way. And it touches a lot of areas that we do not realize. So I think once we control our money and educate ourselves about our money and the effects and where it's going, we will be better as a unity. What I hope will happen now by putting my money in this bank is to be an everlasting statement. Not just we're all mad and upset of what is taking place right now. As my dad, the decisions you make will forever affect your life. And this is one of those decisions that is going to affect my life, my children, and my children's children.
That story was produced in partnership with NPR's Next Generation Radio. Coming up, how to handle a certain offensive word in school. But first, a look back at a historical event in Savannah so tragic that it's called the Weeping Time. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today we celebrate Black History Month with a look back at the victories and tragedies that have marked the lives of African Americans in Georgia. One of those events took place in Savannah more than 150 years ago. It was the largest sale of human beings in U.S. history. 429 men, women, and children were sold over the course of 2 days. The massive slave auction is called the Weeping Time. It tore families apart and inflamed tensions in the lead-up to the Civil War. But this historical event is largely unknown today. Kwesi DeGraft Hansen is on a mission to track down descendants of this slave auction. He's a landscape architect and amateur historian, and he spoke at Emory University about this last year. Help me understand why this huge event happened. What led up to there being so many slaves up for sale at the same time?
Okay, thank you. It's very simple. There's a slaveholder, P. Pierce Mace Butler, he was an absentee slaveholder who lived in Philadelphia. He had actually inherited two plantations on the Georgia coast from his maternal grandfather. He was a gambler and basically spent the fortune that had been passed down to him. And so in 1859, he found himself in dire straits and needed to sell something, either his land or his enslaved people.
And he owned 429 slaves?
Actually, he owned 919.
Holy cow.
And, he and his sister-in-law actually owned the two plantations and the people. So he basically elected to have half of them, which is technically maybe what he felt was his, sold. And so that's how come he had 429 sold to redeem and recoup his losses, basically.
How did they advertise an auction like this in those times? And were they trying to bring in just people that were local, or did people come from all points far and near in order to attend?
All right. They actually advertised it far and near. The point of advertisement began in Savannah. There was a very well-known broker, slave broker, that is, in Savannah by the name of Joseph Bryan. So Bryan was contacted by the Butler organization, if I can say that, to advertise this. So on February 8th, 1859, Butler had this advertisement published not only in Savannah, but in Charleston, in Mobile, throughout the entire South, basically, all the way from Virginia to Louisiana and beyond.
Did you find copies of that advertisement?
Yes. Yes, there are copies. I found copies actually in the Savannah Republican newspaper. There's also a newspaper in Savannah still running called the Savannah Daily Morning News. So in 1859, they published this daily, except on Sundays. And again, so the coverage was wide. And to finish answering your question, when the slave sale actually happened, people came from all over the entire southeastern region as we know it today.
Do we have any idea how many people, unenslaved people, attended?
The only evidence we have is that those who came to purchase slaves, there were about 200 active buyers at the site. Now, that does not include people who are maybe just standing by and watching, but we have an account written by a newspaper reporter from New York. He actually snuck into the South, pretended to be buying slaves just so that he could document this. It's a fascinating, fascinating piece. So he actually records that there were about 200 buyers who were at the auction.
Okay, so now you're focusing on tracking down the descendants of the sale. Why? What are you trying to accomplish by finding these descendants?
You know, this is a travesty, a tragedy by any means.
A tragic travesty. Yeah.
Tragic travesty. Thank you. And I found it very, very alarming that a slave sale of this magnitude happens and it sort of just goes away. We don't want to talk about it. There were no memorials. There are no markers. Now, Savannah has had a Georgia Historical Society marker placed there. But even so, it is really still very difficult for people to find the information. So I think for the descendants, they need to know. Our identities depend on our heritage, our genealogy. And as much as we know, it's always beneficial. And I think that so for an individual who is a descendant, they would like to know, they should know. And then for the general public as a whole, I think it's an important thing that we know these people and that we recognize them for what their ancestors did and suffered through.
Kwesi, you're a landscape architect.
Yes.
How did you end up, and you were, this isn't necessarily your history because you were born in Ghana, as you said. So how did you end up devoting this much time to these 2 days in American history?
All right. Well, I am a landscape architect, and this is landscape history. So that's how I sort of segue into it.
What do you mean it's landscape history?
Well, slavery occurred on the land for the most part. And I was interested in landscapes, and I got interested in a building material actually called tabby, T-A-B-B-Y. It's mostly on the U.S. coastal areas, oyster shells used in construction. But on a trip to research that, I inadvertently stumbled onto a former plantation called Butler Island Plantation. Doing research about it, trying to find more about the tabby, I came across a list of enslaved people who were on the Butler plantations. And I saw my daughter's name, which is a Ghanaian name, Abba. I saw my son's name, my brother's name, my own name. So I was hooked. But that's how come a landscape architect then becomes very interested in the slavery, because I realized a personal connection.
That was landscape architect Kwesi DeGraft-Hansen talking about his research into the Weeping Time. It's believed to be the largest slave auction in U.S. history, and it took place in Savannah. William and Ellen Craft escaped slavery in Macon, Georgia, more than a decade before the start of the Civil War. How they did it and what they did in the years that followed is a spectacular story. University of Georgia professor Barbara McCaskill delivered a lecture about the Crafts at Mercer University in Macon some time ago. She spoke about the story with guest host Sarah McCammon.
William and Ellen Craft met in slavery, apparently fell in love, got married. What do we know about their relationship?
By all accounts, they were very deeply in love. And in fact, it was their love affair that propelled their escape from slavery. They write in their narrative that one of the major reasons that they wanted to be free so they could have a Christian marriage, so that they could be married by a minister, and so that they could have peace of mind, so that they could raise children in freedom without threat of those children being sold away from each other, and so that they could be together without threat of being sold away from each other as husband and wife. Both William and Ellen Craft had experienced firsthand these amputations from family members and friends, and they were bound and determined that to the greatest extent possible that they would remain together in freedom as a husband and wife. So I think that that is a testimony to the extent of their romance and the extent of their love.
And in his 1860 memoir, William Craft does talk about that separation as a rationale for their escape. I'd like to listen to a little bit of that.
It is true, our conditions as slaves was not by any means the worst, but the mere idea that we were held as chattels and deprived of all legal rights, the thought that we had to give up our hard earnings to a tyrant to enable him to live in idleness and luxury, the thought that we could not call the bones and sinews that God gave us our own, but above all, the fact that another man had the power to tear from our cradle the newborn babe and sell it in shambles like a brute, and then scourge us if we dared to lift a finger to save it from such a fate hunted us for years.
Such powerful words and the motivation for William and Ellen Craft to escape slavery. How did they do that?
I think this is one of the most extraordinary stories from the annals of anti-slavery. Ellen had been given at 11 years old as a wedding present to her half-sister. Her half-sister was the daughter of the first man who owned her, Major James Smith. Ellen was the progeny of a slaveholder and an enslaved woman named Mariah. Ellen was biracial, and she looked very much like a white person. In fact, she could pass for white. And because she worked in Macon around the most elite of Macon's white society, she knew their mannerisms. She knew their etiquette. She knew how to speak, how to hold herself. She could pass as an elite, privileged, wealthy white Southerner. So she came up with the idea, William writes in their memoir, of disguising as a gentleman Southern planter. She would transform herself from an African American woman into a white man, and not only a white man, but a white planter. And what is most extraordinary, I think, is that William and Ellen Craft were able to travel openly. They didn't escape by night. They didn't escape under cover of darkness. They didn't flee through the woods, as did so many fugitives from slavery, but rather they traveled on railroads, they traveled on steamships, and they traveled inland on land on carriages from Macon, Georgia, to Philadelphia. And as they write in their memoir, it took them 4 days to do this. They stayed overnight in hotels. And I have to be very careful that your audience understands that they didn't stay together. Ellen pretended to be a Southern planter traveling to Philadelphia for medical treatment. She pretended to have a severe toothache so she could cover her face and not look so feminine. She cut her hair. And William, who looked more African, accompanied her, pretending to be or masquerading as her loyal, obedient, trustworthy, enslaved valet. When she stayed overnight in hotels, pretending to be a white Southerner, he could not stay in the room with her. He either slept outside of the room, as was customary for enslaved Africans who were ladies or men servants to do, or he slept in another part of the hotel with the other enslaved persons. So they traveled together, but their trip was very harrowing because many times of necessity, in order to pretend that they were who they had to be separated.
While they were on this journey, the Crafts' former slave owner sent bounty hunters after them. As I understand it, they didn't get such a warm welcome on the East Coast. What happened?
In 1850, Congress passes a policy called the Fugitive Slave Law, which gives sweeping powers to local law enforcement officials to assist slaveholders like the Crafts' own master, Robert Collins, in retrieving their formerly enslaved persons from the North and remanding them or snatching them back into slavery. Robert Collins determines to make an example of William and Ellen Craft, so he sends two men from Macon, John Hughes and Willis Knight, up to Boston to take the Crafts back. They have arrest warrants, and Hughes and Knight expect full cooperation from the law enforcement officials there and from the other authorities in Boston because that is mandated by law. What they get is a very different kind of reception. Black and white men of Boston have formed a biracial group called the Vigilance Committee, and it acts sometimes like a vigilante mob. Their goal is to do as much as possible to harass, terrorize, and be obstructionists in relationship to Hughes and Knight, and they do just that. They pelt Hughes and Knight with rotten fruit and rotten vegetables and rotten eggs whenever they see them in public. They encourage law enforcement officials of Boston to cooperate with the abolitionists. And these officials arrest and rearrest and rearrest Hughes and Knight on all kinds of charges, from loitering in the streets to driving their horse and buggy too quickly, breaking the speed limit, so to speak, and embarrass them to the extent that they finally decide to go back to Boston with their tails proverbially tucked between their legs. But by this time, William and Ellen Craft realize that they cannot safely stay in Boston. They decide to go eventually to England, where they settle and live for 19 years.
And in 1852, after the Crafts arrive in England, Ellen writes in a letter that was published in the transatlantic anti-slavery newspaper, she writes to refute rumors that she wanted to return to slavery. Here's an excerpt from that.
So I write these few lines merely to say that the statement is entirely unfounded, for I have never had the slightest inclination whatever of returning to bondage, and God forbid that I should ever be so false to liberty as to prefer slavery in its stead. In fact, since my escape from slavery, I have gotten much better in every respect than I could have possibly anticipated. Though had it been to the contrary, my feelings in regard to this would have been just the same, for I'd much rather starve in England, a free woman, than be a slave for the best man that ever breathed upon the American continent.
After living abroad for several years, the Crafts do return to Macon. Why did they come back to that place?
That's a good question. One reason they came back was because they were struggling financially to make a go of it in England. And the end of the Civil War and the freeing of the 4 million African Americans in slavery in the South provided an opportunity for a fresh start. I can only speculate about this, but given how concerned William and Ellen Craft were throughout their lives with the separations that ensued in families during slavery, I have to believe that perhaps another reason they returned not only to the United States, but specifically back to Georgia, where they had been enslaved. Why would they go back to this site of trauma? I think perhaps they thought that eventually they might find more of their family members.
That was University of Georgia professor Barbara McCaskill. She talked about William and Ellen Craft, who escaped slavery in Macon, Georgia, more than a decade before the start of the Civil War. Barbara McCaskill spoke with guest host Sarah McCammon. Coming up, handling the issue of race in the classroom. But first, a TV movie that just may have changed one Georgia teenager's life. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today is a celebration of Black History Month. Sometimes that history is joyful, sometimes less so. Sometimes history can have a profound impact on our philosophies and perspectives. One young man in Georgia had a transformative experience during a screening of the History Channel miniseries Roots. 15-year-old Jason Crichton of Atlanta wrote a commentary about it for Vox Teen Communications. He says the show has encouraged him to take a stand against the casual use of a word that has the potential to offend.
It's time your family pay for all the trouble they have caused me, Kunta. Come peacefully. The ransom negotiations should not take long. Then you can go free.
Go free. I am free.
A thought ran through my mind as I watched a screening of the miniseries Roots recently. This is the best damn movie I've ever seen. As a Black teen growing up in East Point, I am ashamed of how my peers disrespect our culture by not taking advantage of the opportunities that were paid for by the murder and rape of our ancestors. And, like most of my peers and friends, I accepted when others dropped the N-word. I never gave it much thought until I saw those white slave traders show up on screen, spewing the word nigger all over the place. It was a reminder of how much hate the word originally carried.
We spoke at length, no more purchases for a while, and look what you did. Brother, I do not like holding so much of your debt.
What on earth are you talking about? I'm going to get 30 years good service out of him, and have money in my pocket from selling the niggers that he's replacing.
I feel bad that my friends today use it in a flattering way, as if it was created to empower Black people and express pride. Roots enhanced my understanding the way vibrato on a violin enhances a song.
You understand me, Toby? Cuenta gente. No, listen to me. Master's wife done named you Toby.
Cuenta gente.
You feel Kunta Kinte's anger during his fight scenes. His eyes flash bloodshot and his dark brown skin turns dull like burnished mahogany. My struggles are different, lightened by the load he and countless slaves carried before my birth. But I still feel his anger. Before watching this Roots remake, I didn't value the history of African Americans the way I do now. Roots did more for me than any school lecture or textbook ever will. I feel educated and inspired to do something. But one thing I won't accept is the use of the N-word. From now on, when others say it, I'll remind them of the true meaning of nigger.
Jason Crichton is a student at Therrell High School in Atlanta. He wrote a version of that commentary for Vox Teen Communications. When it comes to education, I think we can all agree that students all deserve a fair chance. But research out of the University of California, Santa Barbara found Black and white teachers tend to view their students very differently. The study's author says recruiting more African-American teachers might help bridge the Black-white gaps in school discipline. But others say that's only a part of the solution. Enter Matthew Patterson. He teaches English at Banneker High School in Fulton County, and he's made it his mission to talk about race with his students. I spoke with him and Georgia State University professor Brian Williams. Williams teaches early childhood education. I began the conversation by asking Matthew a straightforward question. Matthew, you are white.
Yes.
And you are in a predominantly black classroom.
Absolutely.
Now, your school is a Title I school?
Yes, it's a full Title I school, full free and reduced lunch.
Okay, so you have a large number of students of color.
Yes, I've actually only taught three Caucasians in my 10 years here.
Holy cow. And can you, going back 10 years, take me back a decade ago when you first entered that classroom. Did you have any idea that there might be an issue of being a white teacher there?
Well, you know, I've seen the movies. Right?
So
that's part of all of our cultural conversation. But I can tell you about my first period. So I planned a lesson that was based on, I thought, something culturally relevant. We're going to discuss one of the Roots, my favorite band, their lyrics, right? So we're going to get into small groups. Well, I came in there full of, you know, private schooling and some of the best education money can buy. And I went in there, and in my first, you know, 2 minutes, I was I was in for a shock. My first moment there, I had a student. So number one, I tried to get everybody in small groups, and it didn't work. And so after that, I went up to an individual student who I later learned to love. But, you know, he said, if you don't get the blank out of my face, I'm going to blank and blank and blank him, right? So that was my introduction to teaching. And I, quite frankly, I wasn't, there's nothing that could have prepared me for that level of animosity.
So, Brian, this brings me to you because you're one of those people that tries to prepare people, right?
Yeah, that's the work I do.
So, yeah. The movie, I mean, Matthew mentioned movies, but the typical scenario is a white teacher goes into an urban school district and saves the day, right?
Yeah.
Inspires
the
all
Messiah.
These. Right.
Yeah.
Inspires all these kids. And it may be, for many people, a real rude awakening when they find out that's not going to happen.
Absolutely.
How do you prepare somebody for what Matthew went through?
Well, I think Matthew kind of is baptism by fire for him, right?
Yeah.
He got into
right.
a classroom and he began to understand, wow, maybe I don't know as much as I thought I did about these children and where they come from. So I think the work that we try to do is to get people to be to at least interrogate their own ideas, their own beliefs, their values, the things that they're bringing into the teaching profession with them. Because I think that for white people in particular in this country, there's not a need for them to constantly think about race and its implications in their lives because they kind of live in a world where they are the norm. And so what ends up happening is you walk into a space where that's not true for other people with that assumption that everybody else lives this way as well. And it creates disconnects and it creates issues in the classroom. So one of the things that we try really, really hard to do is before you even enter into the classroom is to get you to begin thinking about, well, what do I believe? Why do I believe it? Where did those beliefs come from? So that you don't carry things into the classroom with you that might harm children.
Matthew, do you find that you think about race more often now than you did before you started teaching at the school?
Oh, I mean, it's an absolute different perspective. I agree with everything that gentleman just said, 100%, right? I wish I had said it. I feel like, you know, it's for me going into a classroom, I have learned just as much as my students. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but it really is the truth. To me, whenever you put a Caucasian in a room full of African Americans, it's almost like notes on a musical scale that most people have never heard before, right? And for me, part of my own understanding and coming to understand my own place as a teacher is knowing that, you know, I was not nearly as down as I thought I was 10 years ago. I just hadn't been a part of the conversation.
Brian, one of the issues we have in this nation in our public school system is that students of color are more likely to be suspended, they're more likely to be disciplined, they're more likely to be expelled for the exact same offense that, say, a white student would be just spoken to about or would not be disciplined for.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that? Is it partly this sort of gap in racial understanding?
Yeah. I think that it speaks to expectations, right? So I think that for instance, when I work with teachers, oftentimes when they're going into what you say an urban school, right? So, and it's interesting when you say urban child, urban school. Immediately, we have ideas that pop into our head about who these children are, what their parents are, what their communities are like, and so in terms of new teachers, they always want to know, well, how do I discipline? How do I manage the class? How do I keep these kids under control? Because for many people, going into that community, going into that school, it's about control. It's about discipline. They need more discipline in their lives. And so in terms of the school-to-prison pipeline, we kind of this idea of this harsh discipline policies, kicking kids out of the classroom.
Zero tolerance.
Zero tolerance. It kind of speaks to our expectations because for some children, you know, if they're misbehaving in the classroom, if they're not paying attention, we'll look at that child and based on our expectations, we'll say, well, you know what, maybe they're bored. Maybe they need more enrichment,
right.
And they get more work, right? A poor child, a black child who does the same thing, a Latino child that does the exact same thing because of our expectations of who they are as people. It's, well, they're misbehaving because they're disrespectful. Their parents don't talk to them about the way to behave at school. And so they get dismissed or kicked out of the school or out of the classroom. So a lot of it is based in our beliefs, our values about who these children are, who their parents are, and the communities that they come from.
Matthew, how does that jibe with your experience in the classroom? Do you see teachers coming in and feeling like they need to take control of or establish control?
Yes, I mean I can only speak for myself, but I do think that many people want to impose their own thoughts on the classroom, and those don't necessarily work. But instead of learning from their students, they continue to enforce their will. I mean, to me, good teaching is about relationships.
Absolutely,
it's about a commitment to student success. And it's about thoughtful reflection and purpose done by the teacher. And if you're a teacher and you're not going home every night asking, how can I do this better? How can I speak to my students? How can I make culturally relevant material come alive for them? Then you're not doing your job.
So I wanted to put this comment to you, Brian. One of our listeners just tweeted, so the young teacher's story about being threatened by a student on the first day was just a lack of cultural understanding?
I mean, let's talk about humanity, just human beings. I think if a teacher is threatened by a student, I think that's humanity. Things like that happen. And so I think that's kind of an apples and oranges conversation. I think we muddy the waters when we begin to talk about that, because I think what ends up happening is we then can't talk about the real issue, which is that you do have teachers that are coming in the classroom who are unprepared or ill-prepared to actually, what Matt's talking about, be culturally responsive, create instruction that actually is relevant to your children, that values their experiences. We do hear about teachers that are hurt by their students, that are attacked by their students, but I think that's a different conversation. And once again, I think we muddy the waters when we try to conflate and put those two things together.
Could I respond to that as well? Well, so I think oftentimes the students that are most likely to say those types of things are the most in need of individual attention and the most actually wanting. Those are the ones who are broken, right? And to me, I think it's really important because I want to make sure that I say this correctly. Like, that particular student turned out to be one of my absolute favorites in 10 years. We had a great relationship. It was just a rocky beginning, right? And I think that's the main thing, is that not all relationships start well. I can tell you that, right? You know? And so it's really, really important that teachers stay the course, you know? Don't act, because it's a relationship just like any other, right? If you're in the classroom with a person for an hour and a half, you really get a chance to know your students, right? And just like you, I wouldn't want to be judged on a first date for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important that we don't judge students on one comment, you know?
We have about a minute left here, Brian, and I wonder what you make of what Matthew is saying in terms of what helped him get through. He mentioned honesty and authenticity a lot, which I assume means he admitted when he didn't know something about another culture. Yeah. How important is that?
I think it's extremely important. And in fact, I think that's probably one of the best things that we can do as teachers is to begin to try to understand our students. I think that we claim that we understand each other as a nation, that I know what these people are like, but oftentimes it's because somebody else has informed our perspectives. It's either the media, the movies, a book, right? And I think that if we can figure out ways to authentically and you know, really understand who our teachers, who our students are, who their parents are, what their communities are, what languages they speak, what they value, what they believe, that will allow us to better teach them and connect with them.
That is Georgia State University Professor Brian Williams, and we also spoke with Matthew Patterson, who teaches at Banneker High School. Matthew and Brian, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And before we end today's celebration of Black History Month, I want to confess something in the interest of full transparency. I really don't like Black History Month, but not for the reasons that you might expect. I have strong feelings on this subject, so we figured it was time to open the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
Black History Month was the brainchild of eminent historian Carter Woodson. Woodson had a doctorate from Harvard in the 1920s, which is pretty amazing history, if you ask me. In 1926, he wanted to set aside the second week of February as Negro History Week. Why that specific time? Because it included the birthdays of both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. The purpose was to incorporate the achievements of African Americans into the curriculum in public schools. At that point, only three states joined in: North Carolina, Delaware, and West Virginia. Woodson dedicated his life to the issue of education. He once wrote, "This crusade is much more important than the anti-lynching movement, because there would be no lynching if it did not start in the schoolroom." But Woodson thought Black History Month, or week, was a temporary fix. It was meant to fill in the gaps of history until the achievements and contributions of African Americans were included in the regular curriculum. What would he say if he knew we were still segregating Black history into one month of the year, almost a century after he started this battle? Look, there is no such thing as Black history. Slavery is as much white history as it is Black. How do you talk about Thomas Edison and the invention of the light bulb without mentioning that a Black man invented the filament that goes inside? How do you separate education from Robert Smalls, who helped create the nation's first free and compulsory school system in the U.S.? You know who should be proud of explorer Matthew Henson, the first man to reach the North Pole? All of us, because he wasn't just Black, he was an intrepid American. My grandfather was the dean of Black composers, so orchestras often play his music during February only. That drives me nuts. Do we need a Jewish History Month so we can play Copland and Gershwin? Or a European History Month so we can program Bach and Mozart? Look, I'm not saying we don't need Black History Month. We still have not desegregated our textbooks and lesson plans. But maybe it's time. Quit relegating so-called Black history to the back of the bus. To quote Carter Woodson one more time, the mere imparting of information is not education. A little music from my grandfather, William Grant Still, here to close out our show today. If you have thoughts about Black History Month, I want to hear them. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.